Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Breaking and entering, drunk and disorderly, law and order. A former prosecutor and a defense lawyer, not your typical pairing. And the result? Conversations about crime and punishment that are guaranteed to get you thinking.
Welcome to Justice Matters with Joe Crowley and Lizzie Green, a brand new weekly podcast. Our episodes are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. Check out our Instagram for clips at Justice Matters Pod. Enjoy the episode. This episode contains description of violence, including family violence. Listener discretion is advised. Hello, Lizzie.
Hello, Joe.
How are you?
I am very well. How are you?
I am well. Things have been going a bit crazy, I hear, in the Twitterverse.
I did want to have a quick little mention of this because, you know, I'm not extremely technology savvy, but yeah. I have been looking at the TikToks as they come out, and some of them create quite a reaction from the people.
Yes.
Yes.
Particularly the Martin Bryant created a bit of a reaction.
Oh, my goodness. So
that was our episode on
gun violence.
Yeah, and we talked about the Port Arthur massacre.
So literally hundreds of thousands of views,
yep,
and thousands of comments, yep, into the thousands. But I was dumbfounded by how many people think that he is innocent.
Yeah, you said that. That's interesting. So why did they think he was innocent? What are their reasons?
So many. So first of all, he wasn't there that day.
Okay.
Second of all, it was John Howard and the government setting him up to be the fall guy so they could take our guns.
Okay, interesting.
Proof of that is that there was some mobile morgue that was brought into Tasmania the week before, which showed the government had planned it.
Yeah.
There was arguments that he did not have enough of an IQ to do the shooting.
To pull the trigger.
He was left-handed and the shooter was shooting from the right hip.
Wow, okay. Yep. Bit of ballistics.
Oh, my
gosh. Some ballistics experts out
but
there.
It boggled my mind.
Yeah. Well, considering we started that episode, I think you're saying, I'm not sure anyone remembers it, or people of a certain age don't. Obviously, a lot of people do remember it and they think that it was a conspiracy.
I know. I do love the responses to some of those who say, please take off your tinfoil hat. All due respect to everybody's opinions, but that one actually was outrageous.
Yeah. Well, considering he pleaded guilty. So Martin Bryant admitted that he did it. So, yeah, you've sort of got to get around that.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a tough one. But I must say, I love a good conspiracy theory. I think they're always fascinating to look into. So, I don't know, maybe somebody can give us some more details rather than just these sentence, about he wasn't even there.
Let's hear about other conspiracy theories so that you can explore them and I can shoot them down.
I never said I believe them. I said they're entertaining. anyway, we'll see if we get any same kind of reaction of today's case. I'm not sure we will, because although I think it's a fascinating case from New South Wales, I hadn't heard about it until it was all over and I was actually at a miscarriage of justice conference in New South Wales and I heard about it. And you similarly hadn't heard about it
either. No. And then when I looked at it a little bit, I thought, how have we not heard about this?
Yeah. What an incredible case.
Yeah.
All right. Well, let's set the scene. So it's the 28th of August, 1993.
Should we just say what the case is first?
No, I was just going to leave that hanging.
Oh, sorry. I did not mean to disrupt.
People were just like, what is the case?
All right, go.
All right. So 28 August, 1993 in the suburb, it's called Warrenora, I think it's pronounced, which is a suburb off Botany Bay. It's on the Georges River off Botany Bay. I suspect the houses along the river are nice, well-to-do houses. And in one of these houses along the river is Mr. Warner, who at 3-something in the morning, he's not exactly sure what time, he's woken up by an argument between what he thinks is two men, but he said could have been a man and a woman, that lasts about 20 to 40 seconds, he says. Then it stops. He goes back to sleep. He's then woken at just a little before 4:30 a.m. by someone banging his door. He goes downstairs, opens the door, and he sees literally the boy next door, Jeffrey Gillam, who is a 23-year-old who lives next door with his parents, Stephen and Helen Gillam, and his brother Christopher. Now, Jeffrey's standing there in boxer shorts, so middle of winter, he's standing there in boxer shorts, and he is babbling, and he's saying things like, call 000, the house is on fire. And Mr. Warner looks beyond, past him to the Gillam house, and he sees there's smoke coming from under the roof. And so I think by this stage Mrs. Warner's there and they bring Jeffrey inside. And then he starts talking. He's not babbling, but he's talking disjointedly. And what he says to them is, they're all dead. He killed them, set them on fire. Mum and Dad are both dead. He burnt them. I've killed him for what he did to them.
Intense.
It is very intense.
Yeah.
So obviously with the smoke across the road and the things that Jeffrey Gillam's saying, they want to call the police or call 000. So they give the phone to Jeffrey Gillam to call 000. Now, remember, this is 1993, so it's the old-fashioned dial phone.
Yes.
His hands are shaking so much he can't dial the – yeah, well, his hands are shaking. Maybe he could if it was a push button. Can't dial the ringer. And so Mr. Warner does it for him, calls 000 and hands the phone over. And then he says to 000, his brother had killed his parents. He had walked through the door. His mother had called him. He saw that his brother had a knife. His parents were on fire and that he killed his brother after chasing him down the stairs.
That is a nightmare to walk into.
Absolutely. So Mr. and Mrs. Warner are sort of listening to this. Shortly thereafter, well, 10 minutes after they make the call, the 000 call, the fireys arrive and start putting the fire out. And there begins a 19-year saga which sees Jeffrey Gillam eventually, he's convicted of manslaughter on his brother, eventually convicted of murdering his parents and then acquitted on appeal when the prosecution case is unpicked. He's a free man, but this takes 19 years. So, and it is, I mean, I think all miscarriage of justice cases are strange, but this is a particularly strange one.
Was he in prison not for those whole 19 years?
No. So, unlike a lot of miscarriage of justice cases, he only does, I think, about 4 years in prison, but I'll explain how that all comes out. But I mean, when you're innocent, I think
four years is 4 years.
That's right. And it's 4 years away from his children. By the time he goes to jail, he has a couple of kids.
Quick question.
Yes.
So was the brother older or younger?
So Christopher is older. He was 25, Jeffrey 23.
Did he also live in the house?
Both lived in the house with their parents, yeah.
Okay. All right. Just getting the scene.
Yeah, yeah, setting the scene. Well, no, point well made. Let me set the scene a bit more. So I said it's a house on the river, on the Georges River, and so the land slopes down from the road to the river. So you walk into the house on the second level and you go downstairs to the first level and then out onto the back lawn, and down the back on the river is a boat shed. That's relevant because that had been converted into a bedroom, and that is where Jeffrey slept. His older brother had a bedroom downstairs in the house next to the pool room, and the parents, and the parents lived upstairs at one end of the house. The living area was sort of at one end and the parents' bedrooms at the other end. So that's how the house is laid out, and that's relevant to some things that happen. Yeah.
Okay. 93,
yeah, a long time ago. I mean, I recall that there was a big break between the trial, or between the incident and him being convicted, but I'd forgotten it was so long.
And you're probably going to get into this, but like, was he covered in blood when he went to the neighbours? How had the parents been killed? How did he kill the brother?
Okay, the parents had been killed by stabbing. So the father's body showed 28 stab wounds, most of them in the chest, in the front, some in the back. The mother had also been stabbed to death. She had 17 stab wounds, 13 of them in the front, in the chest. What does that make?
28 and 17.
Four in the back. Mm. Christopher Gillam, the brother, he had also died from stabbing, and he had 17 stab wounds. Again, most of them in the front, some of them in the back.
That sounds like a little pattern of...
Yes, does sound like a pattern. But
behavior.
The expert evidence of the trial was that it's not a pattern. The expert evidence from the prosecution says it was a pattern, but the defense expert said not a pattern.
We will explore that. And can I also ask, do you know, did the brothers, were they at uni or working or...
So Jeffrey was at uni. He was studying civil engineering. Mm-hmm. And Christopher, I don't know what he was doing. He was a bit of a troubled soul.
Right.
Well, certainly if you believe Jeffrey's side of the story, which I think the court...
I mean, not that it's all that relevant, but I just like to get a picture of the people.
Mm. Mm. Yeah. So apparently Jeffrey was the favourite son. Him and his father had a very close relationship and they used to do sailing. So Jeffrey was a very good sailor. Not surprisingly, growing up on a river, I suppose.
Yes.
And they had a boat, which was down there at the pontoon, not in the boat shed, obviously, because Jeffrey was living in there, but the boat was on the pontoon and they could take it out. So
it does indicate favouritism, I think, if we look at the fact that the younger child got the separate residence and the older child got a room in the house. I think any eldest child would probably say that's not fair.
Possibly. I mean, it did sound like it was pretty basic quarters down the back. There was no bathroom or toilet there. He had to shower in the house and go down.
So it wasn't a granny flat.
No. And Christopher liked to use a computer, 1993, I don't know, a Commodore 64 or something. And he,
whirring startup sound.
Yes.
Yes.
And that computer was in the house. So maybe, I don't know how.
All right.
Maybe it wasn't favoritism, but, and I'm not sure favoritism played into it, but. Anyway, look, I'll just run through what happened in terms of the procedural history of the case so people sort of get a sense of that, and then we might talk through the facts, and the facts come out at the trial, which you'll get a sense of. So the killings all occur very early in the morning on the 28th. Jeffrey Gillam is charged with the murder of his brother on the 29th.
What?
Yeah, within 24 hours, he's charged with murder of the brother.
But is that because he confessed? He said it was
confessed
him.
Confessed to everybody. In 1995, so this is in 93, so, August 93. 1995, the prosecution accepts a plea to manslaughter.
For the brother?
For the brother, on the basis that they couldn't refute what Jeffrey had said.
But hold on. If the brother has just killed the parents,
yes,
was there any consideration of self-defense or defense of another or anything like that? Like, surely if someone's killing your parents and then you kill them, are you not acting?
When you say killing your parents, well, as I'll tell Jeffrey's side of the story in a second, but they're already dead when he gets to the house.
Oh, okay. All right. So that does change.
Although exactly how dead they were does form a bit of a part in the prosecution's case. But
the plot thickens.
Yes. So prosecution can't refute Jeffrey's side of the story in 1995.
Okay.
They say, we can't refute that. It may, we will accept manslaughter on the basis that you know, we can't prove it was you weren't provoked. And one can imagine, I mean, we were thinking back to our provocation episode where we talked about provocation reducing murder to manslaughter because you were in such a rage that you can't form that intention. And one of the things that might put you in a rage would be finding out that your brother had just stabbed your parents to death.
Well, yes, I fully accept that. But then the other part is that you have to have proved that you lost your self-control to the extent that an ordinary person would. And so that's a lot of stab wounds.
Well, I might just take an issue with that there. I don't think you've got to prove it. Once it's on the facts, they've got to disprove it. So it's enlivened on the facts.
Yes, but so
the prosecution have to disprove.
But the test is that in order for provocation to murder to succeed, you have to show that the provocation, your parents having been murdered, is sufficient to cause an ordinary person to lose their self-control to that extent.
Yes.
And so that's 13 stab wounds, did you say?
17 to his brother.
Oh, 17, even worse. Like
well, that says to me that's a frenzied attack. That seems to, I think that's absolutely consistent with a blind rage, with a provocation, with losing one's self-control.
And this is where we disagree. I can understand a stab or two.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, what have you done? But 17 is persistent and effort and continued thought behind that.
I'm not sure there's thought behind it. There's certainly action behind it.
I don't know. Anyway.
All right. So the prosecution accept that. And we've also talked before about the range in sentencing on manslaughter from anything from, decades. He gets a good behaviour bond.
Stop it.
That's the effect of it. I think it's not even a suspended sentence. One of the things I saw described as a good behaviour bond. I suspect that's not exactly accurate, but so he doesn't serve any time. He is in the community and has to be of good behaviour for 5 years.
Was he held on remand?
I don't know. He was certainly interviewed. I mean, I just think the way he was interviewed was just outrageous. I seem to be the only one who thinks that. Nobody took any
objection. By police?
Yeah, so this occurs 4:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
He is interviewed by police in a long interview at 8:30 a.m., bearing in mind that the guy has, on his own story, been awake since 3:30 a.m. and been
It's fresh in his mind.
Sure. He then does a walkthrough of the house that afternoon, 28th of August. In the afternoon, he does a walkthrough of the house, charged with murder, 29th of August.
But you can understand why they charged him.
I can, but if you accept his story, the emotional state that he must have been in would have been incredible. Interview him in the afternoon, let the guy lie down, have a sleep or something.
But let's just for a moment think about if this was someone who'd come into your home.
Yeah, well, it's his own home, but yeah.
No, I'm saying if someone had come into your home and killed someone and confess to it for whatever reason, maybe they're also very emotional, who knows, are you telling me you would not want the police to be questioning that suspect at that time?
I would want the police to afford anybody that they're questioning an opportunity to not have to be questioned in circumstances where their emotional state might be such and their physical state might be such that they are not, that it's unfair to them, really.
Was there video footage available of that interview?
93. Nobody, as I say, made, as far as I can see, any issue with it. I just, when I was reading it and the timeline is so fast, that I just thought, that is unbelievable. I suppose the thing is he never really wavered from his story. He told the people next door the same story that the ambulance officer, the fire bloke who talked to him, the police officer who talked to him, he gives, as everybody does, there's little differences in versions of events. The biggest difference was whether he took the knife off his brother or the knife's on the floor. But he was effectively very consistent and very open and happy to be interviewed and, do a walkthrough. And he even gives evidence at his own trial. I mean, again, just on the face of it, I'm not criticising his lawyers. I would have said, what are you doing? Don't do that.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So you take objection to the time frame, but he didn't.
He didn't and his lawyers didn't.
Okay.
I'm not second guessing him. I'm just saying that's something that strikes me as a bit odd.
Or a consideration.
Yeah. So he's charged on the.
So a good behaviour bond.
effectively? What is it? I'll see if I get a description of it.
I find that, so I'm going to use this now as a new case authority for how little you can get for manslaughter. Get, yeah. That is...
Well, if you accept his story, it's absolutely understandable.
But if you accept his story,
yeah,
then giving him a good behaviour bond or equivalent is essentially saying, it's okay, mate, we don't mind that you did it.
Well, then, well...
That, Joe, there is no
somebody, you come in and somebody has killed your parents and you...
Yeah,
you,
but so why have the charge? It's a joke of a conviction for manslaughter then, yeah, because that's saying, yeah, yeah, we have just convicted you of the manslaughter of a human being.
Yeah.
And we're just going to let you go and make sure you be good now be good for the next 12 months.
It was 5 years, I think, you had to be good for. But, yeah, absolutely. And certainly there were people who felt like that, particularly his uncle Tony Gillam, so his father's brother.
Fair.
Who worked tirelessly over the next, you know, 12, 13, 14 years to have him charged and prosecuted for the murder of his parents.
Ah, he didn't believe the brother had done it.
Still doesn't. I saw his comments when the Court of Criminal Appeal finally overturned Jeffrey Gillam's conviction, and the uncle was outside court saying it was ridiculous and a triple murderer had just walked away. And yeah, very, very
interesting.
Very strong.
Ooh, family dynamics.
All right, so I'll just quickly run through the prosecution, the sort of how it all proceeded. So in 95, so he pleads guilty in 95 to manslaughter of his brother only. A coronial inquest in 95 finds that his parents were killed by his brother.
Okay.
1997, again, media and the law, this connects to so many of our episodes. 1997, 60 Minutes do a program about how bizarre it all is and isn't this strange and a whole lot of strange things about it.
I
don't know. I didn't see the episode. But it prompts, the next thing that happens is that the police reopen an investigation and that there is a second coronial inquest which determines that a known person committed an indictable offence, i.e. that Jeffrey Gillam was responsible for the death of his parents.
So what had changed between the first inquest and the second?
I think they dug up, or they had some, I think it's that they had some expert evidence which they trotted out. And anyway, I'm happy to say that the prosecutors at this stage seem to be being sensible, because despite what the coroner recommended, the prosecutors declined to prosecute. In May 2001...
So is the uncle involved at this stage?
Tony Gillam, yeah, he's involved at all stages.
With, you know, 60 Minutes from then
I don't.
On.
I hadn't seen the episode.
But from that time, do you think?
I think from day one he was.
So he might have been the driving force.
I don't know, but that would... That would sort of pan out. So in May 2001, he, the uncle, brings a private prosecution for murder.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to one full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
Wow!
Nice!
Yeah!
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Against
his nephew, Jeffrey Gillam.
For the parents.
Now, the DPP, and it's the same up there, the prosecutors up here, if you bring a private prosecution for a serious crime, the prosecutors can step in and take the prosecution over. And so the prosecutors take the prosecution over and then immediately withdraw it.
Yes. So hold on. So a private prosecution means that there is no charge brought by the state.
Yes.
So you are instigating and paying for a charge to be brought against another individual.
Yeah.
So it's against the general idea of the criminal justice system, which is the state versus an offender.
Well, it's sort of the old version of the criminal justice system, because before the publicly funded prosecution service, all prosecutions were private. So,
But so what did you say? The DPP can...
They can step in and take it over, and they took it over and then immediately withdrew it.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, that would have been unpleasant for the uncle after all of this.
Well, it was. Well, I don't know whether it was that caused him to do it, or whether the failure to prosecute it the year before
triggered it.
But at some point he complains about the prosecutors to ICAC down in New South Wales.
Great. He was very busy, Uncle Tony, is it?
He felt very strongly about it. So then October 2004, the police for a third time open an investigation. And produce a brief of evidence in November 2005, and in Feb 2006, Jeffrey Gillam is charged. Ex officio indictment appears in the Supreme Court charging him with the murder of his parents.
Okay, so the 5 years on good behaviour are expired.
Yep.
So he's living with...
By now he's married with kids.
Right, living his life. Okay. And I had read somewhere... just fleetingly, something about claiming an inheritance.
Oh, I didn't see that.
Yes. So one of the things I read was that he was trying to claim his parents'
inheritance
estate.
Yes.
And whoever wrote that particular piece suggested perhaps that Uncle Tony was influenced a little bit by that potential claim.
Yeah.
Which could be problematic in terms of motive there, as in not legal motive, but is this why he's pushing for, because you can't inherit
if you murder somebody, you can't inherit from them, yes. I suppose, interesting. But although if you believe Jeffrey Gillam's story, you could appreciate that he might, since his parents are no longer around, feel he's entitled to inherit their money because, you know.
Oh, 100%. If he is left, you know, an orphan and his sibling's gone.
Mm.
Yeah. But just another little twist in the tale.
It is a little twist. There's so many twists in this tale. Interestingly, and so I've said before and I want to just repeat, I think red flag in a prosecution is the delay between incident and prosecution. And here we got an enormous delay. Another red flag I find in miscarriage of justice cases you often see is a trial's run twice, because the first time the jury can't agree. So they run a trial in, when's the first one? April 2008, jury can't agree. Retry in October, get a conviction in November.
Okay. A hung jury.
Hung jury, as they're called.
Where a jury can't agree.
Mm.
I don't think that can be seen as a red flag. If there's one hung jury and then there's a retrial and a conviction, that is totally fine, because we are talking about 12 lay people who are on a jury. There is no ability to have any knowledge of, you know, preconceptions or biases or anything like that within a jury. To think that you're never going to get a jury where there isn't someone, perhaps like one of the conspiracy theorists, who it wouldn't matter what the case was or how strong the evidence or whatever, who will be a holdout, and that's all that's needed for a hung jury. Mm. So if there's one hung jury and then they retry and get a conviction or an acquittal, fine. I think the problem is if you have multiple hung juries and they're just going back and back and back in the face of an unlikely prospect of conviction?
Well, I if you look at a lot of miscarriage of justice cases, it is not uncommon that somebody will be tried twice and the first jury can't agree. Now, we don't know why juries can't agree because we never find out. So it might be some tinfoil hat holdout who believes Martin Bryant is innocent. It might be that they are struggling with the evidence. And this case has some really curious aspects to it, which I can well understand that they struggled with. So,
but also,
yeah.
So I think it doesn't have to be just one or the other. Like, we had a case we ran in Rockhampton of historical sex offences against a priest. And by the time the matter came to court, he was quite old. He came into court with his oxygen cylinder. He looked very frail. And there was a hung jury. They did not retry him because his health deteriorated even more. But that hung jury, that's not to say that there wouldn't have been prospects for conviction. I mean, at the end of the day, the evidence against him was strong, but who knows why someone is unwilling to convict or acquit, whichever the case may be, because we have to rely on jurors to say, well, I don't have any biases. I don't have any reason why I can't be impartial. But particularly in things like sex offences or things like that, people don't talk about it. They don't disclose it. But they're going to have inherent biases. So,
you don't know it's because they're biased. We don't know what it is. It might be that they are just not convinced by the evidence.
That's right.
So,
but it might not be about the evidence, is what I'm saying. So, one hung jury should not be.
But what I'm saying is, if you look at miscarriage of justice cases, it comes up, I think, more. It's statistically relevant the number of times a person who ends up being found to have been wrongly convicted has had to go through two trials.
Well, do you have statistics? You know, I love statistics.
I know you love statistics. I don't know. I'm feeling like I should go and do a statistical analysis now.
I think you should, because I want to know if that's a fair statement. So
okay.
Watch this space.
Well, I'm not sure I've got time, but yeah, maybe I will. All right. So
you don't like that there was a hung jury?
I don't like. No. I think that's great. There's a hung jury. I think in a difficult case like this, I think that should have been a real warning to the prosecution to continue. Anyway, they continue. They get a conviction on the second one. I mean, this is what happened to George Pell, Cardinal Pell. This is what happened to Henry Keogh down in South Australia. It's as I say, it happens. I see in miscarriage of justice cases. All right. So they get a conviction. He then appeals. Now, there's a lot. He doesn't appeal to 2009. So, interestingly, he's not acquitted until late 2011, I think 2012. So that's the period where he spends in jail. He's given two life sentences. They throw the book at him after the conviction because they say it's a double murder of your parents, which is a heinous thing. And so he's given two life sentences.
Well, and not just like he drugged them and they died in their sleep. This was...
No, very brutal murder.
Very brutal.
Yes.
Were they actually set on fire?
Oh, well, why don't I get to that now?
Sorry.
No, that's right. No, this is a very relevant point.
Okay.
Because I haven't described what it is that Jeffrey Gillam says he sees when he walks in. So I've done the procedural history. Let's talk
Hold on. But so he was convicted and then acquitted when?
He's acquitted. I think he gets I think the court did they heard the appeal, gave a decision acquitting him, but then not giving a final order about whether he's going to be retried until they'd had a chance to do their reasoning. So I think he probably gets out of jail late 2011.
Okay.
Final decision doesn't come down until 2012.
Okay. And there's been nothing since then?
The Director of Public Prosecutions in New South Wales came out and said, we will not appeal this.
Okay.
I mean, it was a 243-page judgment.
We will not retry it, do you mean?
No, appeal. The Court of Criminal Appeal in New South Wales, I won't try and appeal it to the High Court. I think everyone breathed a sigh of relief. The Court of Criminal Appeal did it. I mean, to say it was a thorough job is an understatement. 243 pages. They did not leave a stone unturned in that case.
Right.
So the prosecution service accepted it and nothing further has happened in a legal sense that I can see.
Okay. Jeffrey Gillam. So that is an almost 20-year journey through the system.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
All right. So let's jump back to 28 August 1993. Jeffrey Gillam is in his boathouse bedroom at his house in what's it called, Warrenora, in off Botany Bay. So he is woken. So there's an intercom service, 1993. I don't know if you had one of those in your house. We did for a little while. Intercom, push the button and talk, upstairs, downstairs. So there's an intercom at the house. Just between the kitchen, I think, and the parents' bedroom, there was an intercom that they could push and they could talk, and Jeffrey would hear it down in the boathouse and he could come up for dinner or whatever they wanted to say to him. Anyway, so he is woken by his mother. The intercom's on and she's yelling, but she doesn't, you know, I can't recall whether she's yelling for him or she's in the process of having an argument with someone, but certainly, you know, his mother's panicked voice comes through on the intercom.
But yelling, not screaming.
No, it's interesting. Nobody says screaming.
Okay.
There's raised voices, but a number of people hear the argument. Nobody says screaming.
Okay.
I mean, somebody I think says raised in panic, but nobody says screaming. Anyway.
All right.
So Jeffrey runs up to the house and it's 50 to 70 meters up. He runs up to the house. Runs through the glass sliding doors at the back of the house, and he sees his brother standing over his mother, and his mother is lying there, and his brother looks at him and says, "I've killed them," and lights a match and drops it on the body of his mother, and she immediately lights up, so that there's obviously been some accelerant put on.
Wow.
And that accelerant very quickly then spreads across the floor into the bedroom, and Jeffrey Gillam approaches his brother. And as he's doing so, he looks into the bedroom. He sees his father lying there, and his father lights on fire fairly soon after that.
So did the evidence show that both of them had accelerant on them?
I don't know. They certainly, it was accepted by the prosecution that it was turpentine that was on them and that had started the fire. So, it was the accelerant they used. So Jeffrey approaches his brother, Christopher. Christopher then backs downstairs or heads downstairs. The first thing Jeffrey said was that Christopher had a knife and they wrestled and Jeffrey got the knife off him and stabbed him. He subsequently, when I say he initially says that, he says that to the police officer standing outside, you know, within an hour of all of this occurring.
Mm.
I think in his interview the next day, he's a bit not as, he said, I can't remember, I think. But then he sort of says, I picked up the knife, it was on the floor. Anyway, I must say, I think that's a minor detail. The Crown make a massive deal about that.
Well, I immediately want to know, did he have any injuries, any knife?
Did Jeffrey?
Yes.
No.
So, I mean, if they're struggling over the knife.
He had red marks on his arm, which were consistent, you know, that the neighbour sees, which were consistent with having a wrestle or something. Or, you know,
yeah, but if you're wrestling over a knife, you're going to have cuts on you. You can't.
No, not if you're good enough. It's holding the knife and holding it away, getting your brother. You could conceive of a wrestle where you don't get any cuts on you.
I can't.
Okay.
A knife is a very dangerous thing to be wrestling over, and it's a long blade and easily to get cuts, nicks, whatever it might be.
Well, but you're assuming that Christopher was trying to stab him with it. What if Christopher's just trying to keep it away from him?
Well, okay.
So anyway, what happens? Jeffrey picks up the knife. Christopher runs down the spiral staircase of the house to the downstairs area towards his own bedroom. Jeffrey runs after him, stabs him in the back as he's running. Then they get downstairs. Jeffrey doesn't really recall much of what happens after that, but he knows that he sort of confronts his brother, stabs him. He doesn't know how many times he stabs him. He didn't really remember much of that.
Can you remember what you said at the start? How many of those 17 stab wounds on Christopher were on the back?
I had the stats for the mother, so there were 13 in the front and 4 in the back.
Because I find it curious to stab someone in the back as they're running away from you, and then say, and then I confronted him and stabbed him.
Well, you're in a blind rage. Your brother has just admitted killing your parents.
Confronting someone after you've been stabbing them in the back.
Well, they get downstairs. I think he corners him and then stabs him to death.
So it's not like a confrontation. Confrontation suggests some kind of altercation.
Sorry. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
Corners him downstairs
and continues to stab him.
Next
so I had to chase him down the stairs, corner him, and then stab.
The body, his Christopher's body is lying next to the pool table. So anyway, maybe
he didn't quite get to his room.
Didn't get to his room. No. So Christopher's wearing like a bathrobe. Anyway, so Jeffrey says he stabs his brother, you know, then goes back upstairs. By that stage, he says there's a lot of smoke, and he then runs out of the house, runs to the neighbors, and we pick up the story with Mr.
So
Warner.
So he doesn't try and put the fire out?
Doesn't try and put the fire out, no.
Did he check either of his parents?
No, and that becomes a real issue for the prosecution. They say, why didn't you check your parents? How do you know they were dead?
And so you're saying that with that face.
Oh. Well, I mean, when a body is lying there prone and it is alight, I think it's pretty clear they're dead.
But you watched it. You watched it be set alight, so you know how long it's been on fire for.
Sure.
Like, I would think your instinct would be, and it's been borne out in other cases, you go to the victim and you're checking the victim, and that's why sometimes a perpetrator gets away.
Yeah, but we've talked about this before as well. You know, trying to judge how people react in certain situations, I think, is a dangerous way to do it. We don't know how we would react if we walked in and saw our sibling having just, you know, stabbed our parents and admitting to it and then lighting the bodies on fire. So I think that to place any, you know, beyond reasonable doubt kind of weight on the fact that he doesn't go, oh, is mum really alive or dead, when she's lying there not moving and on fire, I think it's a pretty safe bet. And your brother just goes, yeah, I just stabbed her.
Well, I think if we took a poll, I think you would find more people than not would be checking the victim. I mean, we've got cases where an accused person has just killed their victim and they're still found cradling the body trying to wake them up or revive them. Mm. So it is a very strong instinct to check the status of someone who's injured. Are they alive or dead?
Sure. Revenge is an enormously strong instinct as well, which one, you know, if you come across somebody who's killed your brother
killed your parents. You can't be acting as a fact of revenge for provocation.
Well,
you
can all you like. You are reacting to the fact that your brother has just killed your parents. Now, I describe it as revenge.
Revenge is specifically excluded from the defense of provocation.
If you react in the moment, I mean, you know, semantics. He's reacting in the moment,
Joe,
to what his brother has done.
Is a decision to take retribution. That is revenge.
Yeah, that's why I said it's semantics.
Provocation is saying, I was so angry, I couldn't even think about what I was doing.
Yes, and I think that's borne out by the fact that
revenge is a choice, loss of self-control. Okay. Mm-hmm. This is why I don't like that defense. Anyway, move on.
Okay. The prosecution accept that story in the first instance, in that they accept the plea to manslaughter for his brother.
In 95.
They don't charge with murder for the parents. And so it is not until...
But did they... I know he plead... Did you say he pleaded?
He pleaded.
Did
it was
they
a plea
originally
deal.
Charge Original him
with
murder?
Of
yes.
the brother.
Okay.
And then he pleads to manslaughter because they say we can't disprove
yes,
that
okay,
he wasn't...
Yes, okay, got it.
And that becomes relevant because when they later charge him, cut to, you know, 15 years later, when they do charge him with the murder of his parents, the first thing he and his lawyers do is bring an application to stay the prosecution on the basis that it is... They had a number of bases, but one of them is that it's effectively a sort of a double jeopardy or it's
contravention of the plea deal.
Mm.
Because if they accepted he acted on provocation,
yes.
then they accepted the brother killed the parents.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, unbelievably, I just am always astounded at how judges will tie themselves in knots to make sure that people, you know, go to trial. So he loses all the way to the High Court on that argument. And they say, no, well, you were never in jeopardy of your parents' murder for a start because you were never charged with that. So that's fine. And they say that, you know, there is a scenario that you can think up where you kill your brother on provocation but also kill your parents. And so they... It is unbelievable. Just look at the reasoning. Well, I am just astounded by the intellectual knots they tie themselves into to try and justify this prosecution,
well, I'm just
which they do.
To work out whether that decision about double jeopardy is right. And if we think back to Carroll, who couldn't be retried for murder because he'd been acquitted, but then got tried for perjury, and they said, well, to prove the perjury, you'd have to prove the murder. Here, you wouldn't have to prove, like, you're not actually proving or disproving anything to do with the brother to prove the murders of the parent. So it's not really double jeopardy.
So that's what they say. It's not double jeopardy.
So I think that's probably right.
Yeah. Well, again, the appeal court didn't have any problems with how they ran the prosecution. But the prosecutor, you know, ran a case where she, you know, invited the jury to consider that, you know, it wasn't actually, it was a murder of the brother, or that the story that he tells is completely false, you know, which does impinge the story that they'd accepted
but,
on the manslaughter.
But let's be realistic. When plea deals are accepted, I don't know that there's always a huge consideration of, what implication does that mean for the case originally stated? You know, like a plea deal is often accepted for a number of reasons, and that's probably what happened here. You know, like,
yeah, but interestingly, they accept it. It's not just that they did a plea deal. They don't charge anybody with the murders. I mean, it's quite clear that the parents didn't commit suicide. They were murdered. Nobody gets charged with it. So they accepted the story to the extent not only that they accepted a manslaughter, but that they didn't charge him with murder.
No, I know. And I guess that is maybe a question about the policing at the time, perhaps. But, I mean, listening to what you've said, there are a number of things within his narrative that I would think already are possible areas of concern. And then right at the start, when you detailed to me the injuries to the three dead bodies, that sounds very similar to me. Like the chance of two different killers killing in exactly the same way effectively is very unusual.
Well, interestingly, the forensic expert, Professor Cordner, said that there is that's the way most murders occur. Most people are stabbed in the front. Most people are stabbed multiple times. And actually, if you look specifically at it, there's a number of differences between how they're stabbed. It was agreed that they're all stabbed with the same knife, because the knife that Jeffrey Gillam uses to stab his brother is the knife that his brother used to...
Yeah, that was never in
question. Yeah, so that you can't draw anything from that fact. And this Professor Cordner, who finally comes along, or is evidence has finally comes out in the for the appeal, he said that line of reasoning, which they run in front of the jury, they call experts to say, oh yeah, there's similarities between the way the three people were stabbed, therefore it was only one killer. He said, just cannot do that kind of reasoning.
Why?
Well, because he says that all stabbings are. People get stabbed in the chest. That's where you're always stabbing people.
But there,
you know, so there's no and sort of a frenzied attack. Again, not, you know, that's happens all the time.
I feel like, and we've brushed on this before, but I feel like with expert evidence, it's very tricky. So you are holding out this expert as the one to listen to.
Well, he was the most experienced, and they caught.
Okay, but if you had.
And he had actually done a study of stabbing cases, 45 stabbing cases.
What, and the other experts hadn't studied stabbing cases?
One of them was, I think, just a forensic pathologist who just was like, yeah, when I've looked at cases, this is what it seems like to me.
Why is that different?
Well, one, she hasn't done any scientific, any empirical study of it. But two, she didn't have the level of experience that Professor
Okay,
Gordon
what
had.
Other Crown prosecutors... what other Crown expert?
There was two experts. One, I think, was the forensic pathologist who did the autopsies. Mm.
The wounds.
Okay, I don't think nobody disputed that they were stab wounds done with the same knife. I mean, what you were taken with was the fact that there was the similar number in similar places.
But I think anyway. So who was the other expert for the Crown?
I can't recall.
But so you have focused on the expert. Evidence that exonerated or that led to a finding of not guilty for Gillam.
Sure. But I had not even hearing that, I would have significant problems with.
But so if you had another case, different case, not this guy, but a different case where there were three people all stabbed.
In the same incident.
In the same incident. And you had two people who were at the scene and both of them had blood on them, say, and your client is the one who says, I didn't do anything. The other guy stabbed all three.
Didn't, yeah.
You would want an expert who would come in and say, oh, well, those three people were all stabbed in a very similar way, which suggests there was only one perpetrator. And then you would use that expert to say, this expert has done all of the scientific analysis and can say that these are very similar stab wounds, most likely done by one person.
Well, I wouldn't reverse engineer it like that. I would find out if one, if they're in it. See, I don't think it's a recognized field of expertise for
but
a start.
If that
I'm not
was
sure
that,
you know, who's
expert,
done any study of this.
If that was the expert evidence that exonerated your client, that these three different victims were all stabbed in such a similar way that it must have been one perpetrator, you'd be like, take that to the Court of Appeal.
Take that to the Court of Appeal. Well, I would if it was reliable. But I just think you've got to be very careful relying on experts who, you know, who might get shot down,
but,
particularly
for the
defense.
But you're wanting us to rely on that expert.
Because he as actually is the expert and the court relied on him. So
you can
and the other experts accepted that he had more experience than they did. So
can you see my point?
Your point is that I focus on the witnesses that help demonstrate what I already think.
And if we had a different set of facts with a witness who was saying the opposite, you would be holding that out. I, okay. I beg to differ.
Okay.
Anyway.
All right. So we've sort of started to get into the scientific facts and we've taken a little while to get here. Should we do a second episode?
Well, I am on the edge of my seat. I don't know how much else you want to tell me.
Well, there is a lot to tell you about the terrible scientific evidence that they adduced at the trial, about a whole range of things.
All right.
To try and prove Jeffrey Gillam's story wrong. And this is one of the problems, I think, with the prosecution case, is they don't try and prove, you know, that he murdered his parents. They try and prove that the story that he gave is wrong. And that's exactly what they do to Lindy Chamberlain. You know, they ran the entire trial on the basis that the story that the dingo took the baby is wrong. And they just ran a case disproving that. Similarly here, they just run a case disproving what Jeffrey Gillam said, which as Justice Murphy pointed out in the Chamberlain case, is not a way to run a prosecution. They bear the burden of proving the charge, not disproving the story of the defendant.
Mm. All right. Well, let's
See. We'll do second episode on all the other scientific evidence in the Gillam case and the problems
and the many miscarriage of justice arguments.
Many miscarriage of justice arguments.
Is that what you said was in this?
Yeah. Well, they're similar. I can do similarities between this case and other cases. Yeah, as we've already seen, you know, the retrial, the trying somebody twice is already, I think, a red flag.
I'll have to brace myself for that. All right.
All right. Thanks, Lizzie. Well, I'll see you next time. Yeah. All right. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for tuning into this episode. You can find links to the cases that we discussed in the description. You can also find a link to Guardian Criminal Law, and a big shout out to them for making this podcast possible.
The majority of criminal cases involve people, normal people, people like you, people like me, who find themselves in an unusual set of circumstances that would not usually occur in their life. My name's Mark Savick, and I'm here to assist you with your criminal matter. I look forward to hearing from you and being of assistance to you.
If you're interested in clips, you can look at them on Instagram and TikTok. Just search for Justice Matters Pod. See you next episode.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination. YahooFinance.com.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.